Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On January 15th, the North Carolina General Assembly began its so-called long session, and in just under 2 months, lawmakers have introduced more than 500 bills covering everything from hurricane relief funding to immigration, cooperation with ICE agents, DEI, unemployment benefits, even a bill proposing the state's investment in cryptocurrency. Although Republicans control both houses, the GOP lost their supermajority by one seat, meaning that overriding gubernatorial vetoes won't be a slam dunk. And last week, the House Oversight Committee kicked off their probe into the state's bureaucracy in an echo of what's happening in Washington with Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. It's a lot, and here to help us get a grip on the goings-on are Brian Anderson, Colin Campbell, and Lucille Sherman. Brian is a freelance journalist covering North Carolina politics. He produces the Anderson Alert Substack newsletter, which is quickly becoming the go-to publication for those who follow Jones Street. Not to take anything away from Colin Campbell, of course, who is the Capitol Bureau Chief and political reporter for WUNC, and Lucille Sherman has a similar beat for Axios Raleigh. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So, Brian, as I said, more than 500 bills have been introduced so far. Put that into perspective for the average session at this stage, long or short. Is that a lot of bills or about normal?
Well, let's take them one by one. House bill, I'm kidding.
It's
been certainly very active, but not without good reason. I mean, we've had a hurricane. We've had to respond to. There's a number of new lawmakers, and anytime you have a new wave of lawmakers, they're going to want to put their mark in and show their priorities. There's a lot of changes that people want in response to a sweeping bill passed last year about downzoning, and there's a lot of local bills. So it's a high number, but a lot of these bills, there's a lot of local bills and a lot of new lawmakers who just want to really get the ball rolling quickly.
So, Colin, we have a new governor, Josh Stein, a new House Speaker, Destin Hall. In the House, Republicans are one vote shy of a supermajority, but Donald Trump took the state, and he is running roughshod over Washington. What's the mood in the state house, and is it being influenced by any or all of these developments?
I think it's being influenced by some. Certainly, Republicans in the Raleigh North Carolina legislature really don't seem to have any problem with what they're seeing happening at the federal level, and in fact are trying to emulate some of the Elon Musk DOGE-style review of state government. Of course, here we have a Democratic governor, so there's not the possibility for someone in the executive branch to kind of initiate this line-by-line or agency-by-agency type of cuts and start firing people and things like that. We're not going to see that here from the legislative standpoint. However, there is a new House committee that is based around the idea of government efficiency and going after programs that they think may be potentially targeted for cuts or they view as wasteful or unnecessary. The new state auditor is Republican Dave Bullock. He is also pledged to do more efficiency-style audits of things like the Division of Motor Vehicles. So I think we could see those kinds of things, particularly as we get into the state budget process where revenue may be looking a little bit tight this year, where they're trying to find different programs that Republicans think are not valuable to cut. I would say the one thing that is potentially coming down the pike from Washington that has lawmakers of both parties really concerned is potential cuts to Medicaid, because North Carolina expanded Medicaid just a couple years ago. That's an additional 600,000 people in the Medicaid rolls here. If the federal government cuts its matching funds for Medicaid, the immediate impact in North Carolina, based on the way the law is structured here, is that that expansion goes away. So lawmakers are looking at, could they potentially afford to make up the difference and keep those people on federal government health care if that cut him to pass at the federal level, or to suddenly we have a bunch of people who are losing out on health care in North Carolina as a result of what happens in D.C.
Lucille, as I mentioned, for several years, Republicans have had this supermajority in the legislature, which allowed them to override any gubernatorial veto that might have come their way. This year, they lost that supermajority by one vote, but it doesn't mean that they can't override a gubernatorial veto. It would require at least one Democrat to cross the aisle and vote against their governor. How likely is that to happen in this current political environment?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that with a new governor, he sort of has a fresh slate compared to our past governor, Democratic Governor Roy Cooper, who definitely had a handle on Democratic members and was really able to keep them in line on a lot of issues. It sort of remained to be seen whether Stein will have that same oomph, I think, with Democratic lawmakers. And there are some issues, you know, that Democrats might want to sort of carefully approach with them having to face re-election in 2 years or less than 2 years at this point. It's coming up fast. So I think it could be interesting on issues like immigration and other things that Democrats feel like they might need to moderate on.
And Mike, one thing that should be noted is you don't just need a Democrat to cross party lines in order to override a veto. You could also have that potentially happen if two Democrats are absent. Now, House Speaker Dustin Hall, he has put out a 6-month calendar. So if he, assuming he stuck to that, there would really be no excuses to miss a voting session at this point, which is
something. If two people needed to go to the bathroom, that could be what it takes,
well,
honestly. I mean,
let me ask about that, because if I recall correctly, a couple of years ago, they tried to pull a fast one. They took a vote when they weren't expected to take a vote, and because Democrats were missing, they were able to do what they set out to do. And the same thing could happen with a veto, overriding a veto, correct?
Yeah, that was September 11th, 2019, an infamous day. The legislature, the level of trust that colleagues have had in one another has really not been the same since that time. Ultimately, it didn't really matter because that just kind of hardened the other chamber to show up the whole time. But in theory, that's something that can be done. Maybe not the best move for Speaker Hall in his first year to do that. But if something's truly important, it's an option.
So for people who are newcomers to North Carolina, and there are many, they might not know that for over a century, Democrats held the majority in the General Assembly. Republicans have only held it for 14 years. But Democrats have held the executive branch, the governor's office, for all but 4 of those years. How do you explain that, Brian?
People like divided government. but also, there's been some concerns about candidate quality. The one Republican governor in that time, Pat McCrory, he dealt with House Bill 2 fallout and narrowly lost that 2016 election. Cooper has been pretty popular since then. He had Dan Forrest as an opponent. Josh Stein had Mark Robinson as an opponent. There might be some candidate quality concerns that Republicans might be reflecting on with those choices, specifically Robinson. So Democrats who have been in office for decades, have been political figures. Republicans who have run for governor, as of recent history, have not been political figures for as long. So that's part of it. But the other thing with just the legislature is redistricting plays a big factor in that, and the party in power controls the maps, which ultimately decide who your voters are rather than voters choosing who their representatives are.
Colin, he mentioned Pat McCrory, who was, I think, mayor of Charlotte for 14 years until he became the governor of North Carolina. He hailed from the great state of Mecklenburg, which is not a well-loved place among legislators in Raleigh. But he was a Republican, the only Republican in the last 14 years that has held that office. Does it matter whether the governor in a weak governor state that is apparently becoming weaker through machinations at the state house, does it matter whether the government is a Democrat or a Republican? Because Pat McCrory didn't have an easy time of it.
Yeah, I mean, he really didn't get along with legislative leaders, even though they were from the same party when he was in the governor's mansion. I think ultimately Democrats like to have that extra power to veto things. Certainly you have a much better bully pulpit having the governor's office in your party's favor than you do not. But certainly I think Republican lawmakers at the legislature are somewhat happy to have a Democrat in the governor's office to be sort of a foil, particularly if they have a veto-proof majority, then they can sort of be the power figures in state politics and not have to sort of be seen as infighting with members of their own party. But certainly this, we do have one of the weakest governor's offices in the country by design, both in terms of the Constitution, but also in terms of all the measures that the legislature has taken over the last 5 or 10 years to weaken that office and give it less power. So certainly the policymaking authority all comes from the legislative side and is increasingly going that way with some of the changes that have been implemented in the last couple months and are now tied up in lawsuits.
Lucille, we have this weak governor by design, as Colin just mentioned, and the legislature has been working diligently to further weaken the executive branch, not just the governor, but other aspects of the executive branch. We also have, they have the power to gerrymander, because as Brian mentioned, if you control the legislature, when the census comes out, you get to draw the districts. And they generally have drawn the districts with surgical precision, to quote one judge, to favor their party. So how successful have all these efforts been, weakening the governor, drawing the districts? What has been the impact then on state government, on the law, on democracy?
Yeah, I think I'd say, especially since Republicans are one seat short of their supermajority this year, it's still interesting that they've accomplished so many of their big legislative goals in the last 15 years that they've been in power. They've made major tax cuts. They've majorly overhauled sort of socially conservative policies that they wanted to implement. They've accomplished sort of the bulk of their agenda. And I think is what's interesting is like, what will they further seek to accomplish this year? And so I think that's the biggest impact, right? The biggest impact is that they've been able to sort of move the needle on conservative policies in North Carolina for the last 15 years, sort of slowly, one policy at a time.
I think, Brian, it was you who mentioned the trust level having changed between Democrats and Republicans and the legislative branch and the executive branches. And they seem to attach that trust to the leader of the executive branch. The legislature, I guess maybe after 8 years of Roy Cooper, didn't trust him so much anymore. Josh Stein seems to be in this honeymoon period, which we'll talk about. At least in the view of one legislature, House Majority Leader Brendan Jones, and that came through loud and clear at the first committee hearing for a bill to pay millions of dollars more for years-old recovery projects that are still lingering. He's talking about House Bill 222, the Cooper Accountability Act, which would bring monetary relief for those impacted by both Hurricane Florence and Hurricane Matthew.
Today we're presenting to you the closing out the operations and providing emergency relief bill to you. This is no surprise. We've been dealing with this for many years. I will not bore you with everything in here, but the highlights are that Governor Stein came and he asked for $217 million. He has guaranteed us that this will finish the project. We have put a lot of accountability in here because the previous administration, well, honestly, we couldn't trust them. Money's missing and we're not going through that again. So this time, we're going to hold accountable. We've got plenty of safeguards in here. We're going to wrap this up. We're going to make the people of Eastern North Carolina whole again. And we're ready to move forward helping the governor wrap this up. We feel good about him and his staff that he's put in place, and we're looking forward to working with him to help finally bring an end to this.
So I have a minute left in this segment, Brian, and there's a lot to unpack there. So we'll take it piece by piece. First, why does he trust Josh Stein more than he did Roy Cooper, and how many others join him in that opinion?
Well, as far as dealing with Governor Cooper, he had 8 years to deal with skirmishes, and that kind of disillusions Republicans over time. And Stein, like you said, he's in this honeymoon period. The one thing I will note, it's called the Cooper Accountability Act. Democrats in the Senate responded with a Hall Accountability Act to make redistricting records public records. So they're certainly infighting, but right now it seems to be within the legislature rather than the legislature versus the governor.
So I want to come back and talk about this missing money that he alluded to, and also the fact that the Cooper Accountability Act, Cooper, is an acronym. So let's find out what it's an acronym for when we return. We're here with Brian Anderson from Anderson Alert Substack, Colin Campbell from WUNC, and Lucille Sherman from Axios Raleigh. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what's going on in the legislature as the opening days of the long session are underway with Brian Anderson, editor of the Anderson Alert Substack newsletter, Lucille Sherman, reporter for Axios Raleigh, and Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC. So a moment ago we heard the House Majority Leader Brendan Jones, a Republican, talk about the missing money from hurricane relief efforts for Hurricanes Florence and Matthews that happened, he alleges, under the Cooper administration. Brian, what missing money? How much is it? Where did it go? Why is it missing?
Well, it stands for the Closeout Operations Provide Emergency Relief Act, which just happens to stand coincidentally for Governor Cooper there.
Someone took some time figuring that one out.
Yeah, it's a mouthful. Just say Cooper for short. But really, what has happened is with hurricanes, Matthew, Hurricanes Florence, that brought tremendous devastation to the state, particularly Eastern North Carolina. And as part of this recovery process, there was a lot of red tape that residents went through. There's, some examples of people still not having homes, years and years later, which Republican lawmakers just see as inexcusable. And they pin the blame on that for Governor Cooper and people he appointed to that recovery office. And it's worth noting that Stein has sort of tried to shut that down and create a new office to respond to Hurricane Helene. And so what Stein has basically said is, hey, let's turn the page on those past two hurricanes. We need this $217 million to close those projects out. Republicans have been skeptical because in the past, you know, costs have gone up. Some people might say building materials have gone up, inflation's gone up, other things have caused the cost to be higher than expected. But certainly, if there's bipartisan agreement on one thing, it's that nobody's happy with what these people are still having to go through.
And of course, one of the first orders of business this time around was focusing on yet another hurricane and the relief money for that, additional relief money for that. We're talking about Hurricane Helene recovery efforts in Western North Carolina. The state Senate drew up a bill that directs $533 million in additional funding. Here's Republican Senator Kevin Corbin, who represents Cherokee, Clay, and Graham counties. He acknowledges that this is just one more step in funding these efforts, with more to come.
This is the fourth round of funding, and there'll be more. And living in that area, those of us who are in the affected areas understand this is a long-term fix, long-term solution, long-term funding.
So the House came up with its own relief package of slightly less money, $500 million. It passed unanimously in that chamber, but both bills are about half of what Governor Stein has proposed. Last month, he called for an additional $1.07 billion, doubling the money that has already been made available. And the people of Western North Carolina have been crying out for these funds, Lucille, because all during the break they needed that money and they didn't come back into session to make it happen. And they waited a while to start on this. So where is all this, Lucille, in the process?
Yeah, I think one thing that's worth noting is last fall, whenever the legislature worked on these bills, they noted that this was before President Trump came into office, but they noted that they didn't want to get ahead of the federal government and spend money that the federal government might be giving them instead. So that's one reason why they've sort of proceeded with caution and proceeded slowly. They don't want to spend money that the federal government might give them. So I think that's one consideration. And then the other thing that's complicating this is that we're not really sure what the future of FEMA is. We're not really sure what the future of a lot of federal funding is. There's a lot of it in question. It's been slow to sort of reach Western North Carolina, as has state money. So I think there's just a lot up in the air that's made it a frustrating process, especially for people on the ground. But Republicans in the legislature argue they're moving as quickly as they can.
So, Colin, both the House and Senate versions of this funding bill have earmarked various aspects of this money for certain projects. If nothing much changes, how is this money scheduled to be used?
Yeah, so a lot of the, I think one of the biggest line items in both the House and Senate bill is to start the housing reconstruction process. A lot of that will ultimately be federally funded, or at least we think it's going to ultimately be federally funded. But as we were discussing before with the program that was put in place after Hurricanes Florence and Matthew, the federal funding is really, really slow to come down the pipeline on housing. So this isn't a goal, has a goal of getting that started now and possibly getting reimbursed later so that people aren't waiting years and years to get their homes rebuilt. There's also money in both of these bills for debris cleanup, which is a big worry. A lot of the downed trees and things like that are potentially fuel for wildfires as we get into the warmer months. So that's a big issue. There's money in there for local fire departments that have seen impacts. There's a variety of other things that popped in there. One thing I'm watching to see whether it ends up in the final, the Senate and the governor have called for money for summer schooling programs to help with some of the learning loss. A lot of these schools were out and closed for a really long time. And so that's in the Senate version, and the governor's proposal was not in the House version. There's also money in the House bill for rental assistance payments for people who you know, are at risk of being evicted from their homes related to the storm. That is not in the Senate version. And then the governor and Democrats have been calling for assistance to small businesses. And that has not been put in any of the bills so far. But there is some crop loss funding for farmers in both the House and Senate measures. So all of those are sort of moving parts as we go into next week when they're likely to make some final negotiations on this bill and get it, potentially get it passed.
Brian, some have warned that the state government is going to fall off a fiscal cliff because of a shortage of revenues, et cetera. And given what we know about the state's budget and the politics involved in these hurricane relief efforts, we have these two different bills at two different amounts, and the governor has his own wish list at a substantially higher amount. What do you think the actual amount they appropriate will be? And if it does not approach what the governor is suggesting, is he likely to veto it, or would that be bad politics at the moment, given the need?
Yeah, I mean, if he vetoes this bill, he's going to have some tough battles for re-election in 4 years. So it doesn't seem like it would be wise politics to veto this. Democrats have universally supported this. And, you know, I think a lot of people would take the logic that half of what we want is better than none of what we want. It's probably going to pass. It's going to become law. As for what might the final amount be, you know, 500, 530, something in between, or around that is sort of the ballpark of what we're looking at, 500 mil or 530 mil. The one thing I think it's a little weedsy, but it's important to note, is last year there was Senate Bill 382 in the lame duck legislature, passed in December, and that was a 132-page sweeping bill. That provided 225 or so million for Helene recovery, but that was money transferred from one fund to another. It didn't actually go out the door to people. This bill has money going out the door to people. So this is actual dollars going to Western North Carolina. And essentially what it's doing is it's having anywhere from 275 mil to 300 mil in addition to what was appropriated last year. So there's, if you really want to be technical, this is really a $300 million new funding bill and spending money that was already appropriated.
Colin, I suppose there's an urgency to all of this. This money is needed by folks in Western North Carolina. Are they moving at a snail's pace here? Are they moving at the average pace that it takes to get bills through? Because it has to go to the governor. It has to come back. There has to be reconciliation between the House and Senate, et cetera. Is this moving at a normal pace, or is it accelerated? We just don't see it.
I mean, it is one of the first things that's going to cross the finish line for this legislative session. So things do tend to move fairly slowly. I will say with disaster relief bills, sometimes they can essentially do all the backroom negotiating ahead of time, which is what we saw last fall when they passed two rounds of initial hurricane relief in October. Those went through the process in about a day or two. This is taking a good bit longer. And it's all against the backdrop of, you know, this is a small percentage of the, I think it's $16 or $17 billion that are likely coming to North Carolina through the disaster relief legislation Congress passed in December. But a very small amount of that money has actually gotten out on the ground. So I think the challenge is even once they pass this, there's still some steps in terms of the state agencies or local agencies getting the funding before it actually gets out on the ground and the money actually correlates to actual recovery work being done, whether it's rebuilding homes or clearing debris or whatever it may be. This is a very long process. And certainly when you talk to people in this part of the state, there's a lot of frustrations that the government response has been incredibly slow, because we're a good distance out from the storm and a lot of stuff still needs to happen before they're anywhere close to where they were before Helene hit.
So Governor Stott, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and just in terms of the politics of this, like Colin said, you have a lot of very frustrated people, but the problem Republicans have is when you say we need to wait to see what the federal government does, and the federal government is having some chaos right now as to what it looks like. When you keep finding reasons to kick the can down the road on conversations that maybe could have happened over the course of the last few months, people are going to be very frustrated and just see that as inaction. There are some good reasons for why it's been slow, but at the end of the day, in terms of politics, people want this to have been passed yesterday, months ago. It's already past due.
So trust in Raleigh at the legislature seems to be in short supply. And one area where it's demonstrated rather clearly was with former insurance commissioner and now former DMV commissioner Wayne Goodwin. He stepped down the same day that he had this exchange with House Majority Leader Brendan Jones.
There's been years to fix these problems. You decided to bail on it. Understandable.
I didn't
why,
bail.
Why should North Carolinians believe anything that's being said today?
Well, first of all, I didn't bail. I decided not to reapply. There's no guarantee that I would be selected, so I didn't bail on something. I'm deciding to
help. Do you feel like you would have been selected? Do you think your performance would have the merit to be selected again?
Yes. That's my opinion.
We all have one.
Yes, we do.
Swing. So this was part of a hearing held by the state's own DOGE committee, which we will talk about in a minute. But first, Lucille, put that exchange into context. Was this strictly about long wait times at the DMV, or was there more to it than that? And was Wayne Goodwin's decision to step down that same day as the agency's head the direct result of that hearing?
Yeah, I don't know I can't really say for sure if it was the direct result of that hearing. The timing was certainly interesting. I do think that Wayne Goodwin has faced so much criticism and also frustration just from the general public from his handling of DMV. There's been not only long wait times, but taking a long time to produce licenses. I mean, anybody who's gone to the DMV in the last year or two, especially who has tried to make an appointment, knows that it's been very difficult to do that. I think what the legislature has been trying to drill down on is like how much of this is Wayne Goodwin's fault himself and how much of this is just sort of circumstances that were dealt to him. And I think that's sort of where this legislature is trying to like thread the needle on that. Also,
I mean, have things gotten worse? I mean, all of us have to go to the DMV on a regular basis to get licenses renewed, to change license plates, etc. I've just gone through this myself, and it was particularly onerous this time, but not that much more so than the previous times that I've been. At least that's my anecdotal opinion. Are things really worse?
I think so. I mean, the DMV isn't ever particularly a joyous experience by any means. But the lines at the DMV are so long that people who work full-time jobs can't make it through the line, even if they've made an appointment. That is, people who work full-time jobs or work hourly wage jobs should be able to go and get their license, you know, within a few hours. The fact that they can't is astounding, but I will say part of that is Wayne Goodwin can only do so much with a limited staff, and the legislature has cut funding across all state agencies over the years. And I don't think Wayne Goodwin's DMV is really immune to that. So he's arguing, you know, short staffing is a big part of that. So how much of that is his fault? That's what
And staffing might become even more short in the coming months. Elon Musk, of course, we know is running the Department of Government Efficiency in Washington. Efficiency may not be the right word, but nonetheless, he's in charge of taking a sledgehammer to things up there. It's become highly controversial for myriad reasons. And now North Carolina conservatives, Colin, appear to want something similar. And House Majority Leader Brendan Jones, who chairs the House Oversight Committee, promises, quote, a series of hearings to evaluate if agencies are effective and efficient. They have summoned the heads of various agencies to have them explain how those agencies make life better for people in the state. At that first meeting, he announced, quote, that's why we're here, to oversee, to ask what's working and what's not working. We want to know if North Carolinians are getting what they pay for. At least this is happening among elected officials, unlike what's happening in Washington. How do they plan to approach this?
Yeah, I think the process here, and it seems to be largely based in the House. The Senate doesn't seem to be quite as interested in doing this kind of granular review of what different state agencies do. But I think as the budgets are crafted, the sort of through line we'll see through this is if there's an agency that this particular committee views as wasteful or a program they think is not worthwhile, you could see that cut in the state's budget. Another interesting bill that the House is moving with this week would take the state to a process called zero-based budgeting, which, to get a little bit in the weeds, right now most state agencies go into the budget process and they get the same amount they got last year, but then they ask for more. If you went to zero-based budgeting, all the agencies would have to justify all the funding they're already receiving, and that number could change or drop depending on the year. So that seems to be the direction the House is going in. Whether we see the Senate want to get that down in the weeds on different state agencies, I think, remains to be seen. But certainly, sort of broadly, I think you could see budget cuts on the horizon, but you won't necessarily see the abrupt firings you see in the federal government, because the executive branch is controlled by Josh Stein, not someone who can suddenly just go in and tell people they're no longer wanted in their jobs.
One of the focuses of these DOGE efforts will be DEI, which has already been eradicated at the federal level. And again, House Majority Leader Jones, this time speaking on House Speaker Destin Hall's Member Minute Shorts on X, talking about his bill to remove DEI from state agencies.
DEI in North Carolina is done. My bill, House Bill 171, is putting an end to it in North Carolina. It's time to make merit matter again, and to ensure we're recruiting the best and the brightest to work in our public sectors.
And House Member Brian Echeverria, a Republican from Cabarrus County, asked department heads from every agency if they had DEI staff or engaged in DEI practices, and asked a key question.
We are excited here in the State House, and we're going to be having our own DOGE. The question is, can we expect your full transparency and cooperation with the people of North Carolina when our DOGE committee begins?
Brian, I have 40 seconds. Did he get an answer?
Well, I spoke with Representative John Torbett yesterday, who's leading a DOGE-like effort. And right now he said the process so far is constituents send emails with concerns about issues. And as for what's going to happen going forward, I'm told in the next coming weeks, we might see a public dashboard to really make this process more user-friendly and accessible. So that's the transparency side, at least.
When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about these DEI efforts at the state level, because we've already known that they've taken care of that at the federal level, apparently. Well, we'll talk about them in North Carolina when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Brian Anderson's with us. He's the founder and editor of the Anderson Alerts Substack newsletter. Colin Campbell is Capitol Bureau Chief at WUNC in Durham and Chapel Hill. And Lucille Sherman is reporter for Axios Raleigh. House Bill 171 would prohibit all state agencies from implementing or supporting DEI programs, policies, or initiatives, and includes criminal penalties for those who knowingly violate the ban. And it also calls for the impeachment of elected officials for failing to comply with the ban. Some black lawmakers were highly critical of this bill. Senator Candy Smith, a Democrat from Greenville, who chairs the North Carolina State Legislative Black Caucus, told a news conference that her peers had just introduced a bill that could result in her impeachment because she is black.
If I celebrate my culture, they're trying to impeach me. So it's important for me to learn your culture, but you can't learn mine, or I can't learn mine. So if I'm teaching anybody about how I grew up, what I learned in life, as far as me and my ancestors, I can be impeached.
Colin, is that hyperbole or is there truth given the way the bill is written?
I think this bill is written really broadly, which is what Senator Smith is getting at. I don't think necessarily the intent of the bill is to impeach her for talking about the fact that she's Black. But the problem with these DEI bills, I think, in general, is that there really isn't a firm definition of what is a diversity, equity, inclusion program. I think Republicans, when they talk about it, they're thinking about a you know, office within a state agency or whatever that's designed to, you know, recruit, you know, non-white candidates and give them a extra point on the job search, things like that. Whereas when they actually write it out and try to explain it, it gets so broad that it catches potentially people just merely talking about Black history or things like that. And I think that's going to be one of the challenges if these bills come to pass, whether it's the House bill that we just discussed or the Senate bill that went through this week that is getting at DEI and banning it from K-12 schools. What does that actually look like in practice? And what are the specific things that are banned? And what can you still do that relates in any way to diversity?
Like so much of so many other things in the world today, at least in our country today, there are diametrically opposed views of what DEI is. So let me go back to a moment, for a moment, to what we heard Brendan Jones say a moment ago about DEI being dead in North Carolina.
It's time to make merit matter again, and to ensure we're recruiting the best and the brightest to work in our public sectors.
Well, here's what Representative Candy Smith's take happens to be on that.
This is diversity, equity, and inclusion. We're not talking about someone trying to injure people, cause harm, do anything negative. We are talking about trying to include individuals who have been excluded for the majority of the time to ensure that we have the best and the brightest.
So Brendan Jones says DEI results in our not being able to get the best and the brightest. She says it results in our being able to get the best and the brightest. Two diametrically opposed versions of the path forward. If you polled, Brian, every Republican and every Democrat in the General Assembly, would we have the same split?
I think we'd have a very, very similar split with maybe a couple moderate Democrats open to the bill. What I will say is that the reality probably lies somewhere in the middle where, you know, in some hiring situations, maybe DEI is a factor that results in not the most qualified person getting the job. And in other cases, if you reach out to people who might not have been reached out to, that can land you a really, really good person who is the best and brightest for the job and just and happen to get it when they might not have otherwise applied. So, I mean, everything is so case by case, but the reality is if you're looking at hiring in for education, for state agencies, there's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of people who don't want these jobs to begin with. There's a lot of trouble with staffing already. And the easiest, the most simplistic concern I have heard is that if you really care about education, why don't you pay teachers $50,000 a year? So there are things you can do to make this more inclusive for everybody, if that's your concern.
So in D.C., the DOGE effort is they want to follow Grover Norquist's prescription for government to make it so small that you can drown it in a bathtub. And if they're successful, they will lay off tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of federal workers, and not just in D.C., but all over the country, including North Carolina. And now, Lucille, we have this DOGE effort beginning in North Carolina. If our state engages in something similar and does something similar, has anyone discussed how that might impact these two things together? Unemployment levels, or whether the private sector could actually absorb all of these people?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is this DOGE effort in the state legislature, they've talked about privatizing, for example, the DMV. So certain agencies could become privatized as a result of that. I don't know if we'll see sort of the sheer scope of layoffs that might hit the federal government in North Carolina. But as I said earlier, so many of these state agencies are already understaffed and pay their workers wages that aren't appealing to a broad variety of people who want to work in state government. And so Depending on how these efforts play out, this might not make that situation any better.
Meanwhile, our state has among the stingiest unemployment benefits in the nation. I think it's a maximum of $350 a week. Democrats have been pushing to increase that, and now Republicans appear to be getting on board with that. House Bill 48 would raise the maximum benefit by $100 to $450 a week, or about $1,800 a month. I would challenge you to try to live on that. But why the turnaround, Lucille? Why are Republicans getting on board?
Yeah, I mean, I think just as you said, it's one of the lowest in the nation. I think they're seeing that there's really no way, especially amidst rising inflation prices, a dozen eggs is like an average of $8 a dozen nationally. So this is something that I think they have pushed aside for a long, long, long time. And I think they might just be reckoning with the idea that they can't keep sort of pushing this issue to the side. They might need to bring this issue to the forefront if they want to have a successful time getting reelected.
So people on unemployment right now are getting a higher benefit. They're getting $600 a week since Helene hit because the state had to increase it in response to that situation, but it increased statewide, even in counties that weren't hit by the storm. And that's going to expire, I think, sometime this month, and it will go back down to the $350. So this would just take it back up to $450, and Democrats are arguing that $600 is a much more reasonable number, but I don't think that's what Republicans will ultimately go for.
So,
and
Brian, we faced this.
If it just kept up with inflation from when it passed at $350, it would be like $476 today.
So if we're facing this fiscal cliff, and some say we're not, but if we are, and we start laying off people in state government, and the federal government lays off people who are employed in North Carolina, and we raise unemployment benefits, Brian, can we afford all this? This sounds like a perfect storm to me.
Republicans have said these types of doom and gloom predictions have been made before, but what's different this time is by the end of the decade, we have a phasing out of the corporate income tax to 0%. That hadn't happened in the 2010s. We have lower income tax rates over time if certain income thresholds are hit in statewide revenue targets. So there is some protection, but there are some automatic triggers currently in place that could harm the state's fiscal situation. To the DOGE point earlier, if you're looking for waste and fraud or abuse or government picking winners and losers in hiring practices, the two main complaints I have heard have been with the e-court system and how automating and digitizing these court records have really led to high cost overruns. That's something that could be looked into. There's, I think, $500 million for the NC Innovation Fund, which really gives out grants, and that can be seen as picking winners and losers. The problem with the DOGE effort is as you're looking to try and cut things back, you really have to point the finger at yourself since Republicans have been in charge of the state since 2011. So that's kind of the irony of the situation.
So we have 8 minutes left, and I have several things I want to get to before we wrap this up. Senate leader Phil Berger spearheaded the new bill that would ensure that the state is helping the Trump administration carry out its immigration enforcement efforts. The entire Senate Republican caucus signed on to support this bill. Brian, what would it do?
So Colin's probably the one who's most closely tracked this.
Okay. Colin, what would it do?
Yeah, so this is basically requiring other law enforcement agencies and state government to comply with ICE, for the university system in North Carolina to comply with ICE, sort of expanding on a bill that passed last year that was requiring sheriffs to do just that. This is sort of the Republicans inserting themselves into the national immigration debate and trying to get at that. And there was another bill filed just last night by House Speaker Destin Hall that seems to be targeting the Mecklenburg County Sheriff, who he argues is still not complying with ICE under the last bill. So this seems to be the big touch point.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, Lucille.
One other thing I thought was interesting in that bill is that it directs the state to sort of comb through whether any illegal immigrants are receiving state funds or government funds. I don't know where that's happening, and I don't know how that process will work. That's an interesting thing worth noting as well.
So getting back to this, Speaker Destin Hall has pointed to this ongoing dispute between ICE and Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden, who at first would not cooperate with ICE because he said it wasn't legal, and then changed his stance somewhat and evidently says he does not have to inform ICE. He can inform them when he has somebody in custody, but when the custody term runs out, and he is forced by law to let them go, he does not have to inform ICE that he's about to let them go. He says that's state law. If that's true, have lawmakers looked into changing the law?
That seems to be what this is getting at. I think I haven't looked in the down and dirty details of exactly how this is being interpreted, particularly in Mecklenburg County. But I think that seems to be, to the extent that there's any sort of loophole that Sheriff McFadden is using as he assesses his relationship with ICE, this Destin Hall bill that came out this week seems to be designed to close that and make it clear that, you know, he has to do exactly what lawmakers are intending for him to do on that front.
And Lucille, before we move on to another topic, House Republicans filed a bill on Monday to increase criminal sentences for undocumented people convicted of felonies within the state. What does that bill suggest?
Yeah, I think it's sort of along the same lines that we're seeing here across the board. It's sort of bringing the state of North Carolina in line with the efforts that the federal government is making to sort of crack down on illegal immigration. Across the board.
So House Bill 87, O'Brien, would require all school districts to limit phone use unless a teacher incorporates those devices into a lesson. The Observer reported yesterday that it would also include computers and laptops, tablets, etc., that aren't part of an assignment in the classroom. A Pew Research study found that 1 in 3 teachers consider cell phones to be a distraction, a major problem. Does this bill have bipartisan support?
Well, I'm surprised it's only 1 in 3 teachers, I think there's a bill that's certainly going to get over the finish line. It's just a question of how strict will the cell phone ban policy be. The House wants this, the Senate wants this. That's usually a sign it's going to happen. The question is just how strict will this policy be? My sense is that it's going to land where there's some flexibility for the teacher to incorporate technology into their lesson plans and make sure that's not at risk. I know when I was a student, there were some computer-based devices that were necessary for lessons. But really what this is trying to target is text messaging during class and things getting out of hand.
Well, Senate Bill 55, I think, passed last night on a bipartisan 41-1 vote, passed on Tuesday, to require a ban on students having their phones turned on during class. What are parents saying about this? And is the legislature taking that into consideration, Lucille?
Yeah, I think what's been super interesting to me about this is parents sort of have mixed views on this. You can find parents on either side of this issue. That's making some state lawmakers nervous about making their constituents happy. But I do think, you know, we're seeing a lot of parents who understand that this is a problem, but teachers are the ones in the classrooms experiencing this. So I feel like they're sort of the biggest activists on this issue. But yeah.
So Donald Trump has his own cryptocurrency. Melania Trump has her own cryptocurrency. Donald Trump has suggested the federal government should put some of its funds into crypto, and now a bill sponsored by House Speaker Destin Hall, the Digital Assets Investments Act, would push the state in that same direction. He says cryptocurrency investments, quote, have the potential to generate positive yields for our state investment fund. But economists and monetary experts say that crypto is not an investment. It's like going to Vegas. You might make a lot of money, you might lose a lot of money, and they want to put about 10% of this money in this latest iteration of bills, 10% of it into electronically traded funds based on cryptocurrency and put it into the retirement fund. What's at risk here, Colin?
I think that's a big concern. That's why we saw the State Employees Association of North Carolina come out strongly against this bill. The argument for it is, well, maybe this could increase the returns in the state employee pension plan, something that they need to do one way or the other. But there's a concern that the volatility of cryptocurrency, even in this sort of limited, give the state treasurer a full discrepancy on how much money they actually put into this and do it sort of through a mutual fund format rather than direct investment in Bitcoin. There's a big worry that could put pension investments at risk if it's not handled, you know, carefully.
Would they be better off just putting that money in state education lottery tickets?
One argument you'll hear from opponents of this bill, that this level of risk is a little too close to gambling.
So all three, very quickly, I have less than a minute. Anything you're covering, anything you know about coming down the pike that we should be watching carefully? Quickly, Brian.
There's a bill on non-compete agreements for employees who make less than $75,000 a year. It would ban that. That's something to watch because, ironically or surprisingly, Dustin Hall seems to be supporting that.
Lucille.
CBD, THC, that kind of stuff. I think it's definitely worth watching how the state legislature regulates medical marijuana and hemp largely.
Colin.
And to that end, I think healthcare affordability in the state with high healthcare costs will be a big theme going forward. There's some more bills coming down the pipeline on that front.
And we need to watch what happens with Medicaid should the federal government make changes, because we're hanging by a thread here on that. Brian Anderson from Anderson Alert Substack newsletter, Colin Campbell from WUNC, and Lucille Sherman, reporter for Axios Raleigh. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.